And Sue, anytime you'd like to get started.
Okay. Well, a very warm welcome to all of you who are joining us for tonight's panel discussion on racial justice and special education. I'm Sue Keisler, Executive Director of Partnership for Extraordinary Minds, otherwise known as X-Minds. For those of you who are not familiar with X-Minds, and I know we have people joining us from all over the place at this point, we are a volunteer-led nonprofit organization in Montgomery County, Maryland. And we're dedicated to improving education for K-12 students on the autism spectrum. We do this by supporting both educators and parents of autistic students. We offer them autism trainings, speaker events like tonight's, workshops, online resources through our website, also individual guidance for parents who are navigating special education in our local public school district, which is Montgomery County Public Schools. I would like to say that we have been a predominantly white organization. Most of our volunteers and most of our members are white, and we would like to change that. The student population in Montgomery County Public Schools is 63% Black, Indigenous, and students of color. And within the special ed student population, that number is even higher. In order to meet the needs of our parent community, we hope to involve more BIPOC parents. And I would like to take this opportunity to announce that we have formed a new committee that will focus on outreach to those families. And like I said, we are volunteer led, so we welcome new volunteers. If you're interested in being involved in our work, please contact us for more information, and you can see our email and phone number on the screen. So getting to tonight. Tonight, X-Minds is hosting a panel discussion about the racial disparities in several aspects of the special education world. Moderating this discussion will be Kim Pinckney Lewis, who has been a longtime member of X-Minds and now a member of our advisory council. Kim is a doctoral candidate in the Instructional Design and Technology program at Old Dominion University. Her research interests include exploring the intersections between adult learning theories, special and differently abled populations, digital age technology demands, best practices for assessment and evaluations, and maximizing knowledge transfer. She is also the proud mother of a child on the autism spectrum. We're very pleased and honored to have you here tonight, Kim. And I'm going to turn it over to you to introduce the panelists and start our discussion.
Well, thank you so much. I am super excited to be a part of this panel tonight, and even more proud to be a part of the Partnership for Extraordinary Minds. The work that they do is quite outstanding. Just a couple of ground rules really quickly, or some things to note for tonight's discussion. This session is being recorded, and so if you do not want your face or your likeness to be shown in a recording that would then be posted on X-Minds website, you can turn off your camera. We also do ask that all participants mute their microphones, and we will do the same if we're not talking. If you have any logistical questions, please feel free to put those in the chat. We have someone who's monitoring that. Our agenda for tonight is pretty jam-packed. We have a lot of great questions and a wonderful panel that you'll get to meet in just a few minutes. So there might not be a chance to get to questions from you as our audience. But if you do have logistical questions, go ahead and put those in the chat and we'll make sure that we get back to you. So without further ado, this panel of folks that I'm super excited to engage in discussion with, I am going to call on them one by one to sort of introduce themselves, their background, and sort of their work. And we're going to go in the order in which you see them on your screen. So first, I would like to introduce Joy F. Johnson. And Joy, if you could just share with us a little bit about your background, the lens that you bring to this discussion, that would be great.
Okay. I am Joy Johnson. I'm a behavioral specialist. I'm also autistic. I'm also the parent of an autistic child and the grandparent of an autistic adult. And I work with several organizations and individuals to improve the lives of autistic people through inclusion and behavioral services.
Thank you so much. We're so excited to have you. Our next panelist is Dr. Delarius Stewart. Would you please introduce yourself, share a little bit about your background and sort of what lens you bring to this conversation?
Good evening. Thanks so much for having me. I'm Delarius Stewart. I'm a school psychologist, actually, by training. I've practiced as a psychologist in schools and have provided mental health services in the clinical setting as well. I've taught general education and special education in the K-12 setting, And I've actually trained future special educators, counselors, and psychologists at the university level. But the most important thing about me, though, is the fact that I'm an individual with a learning difference. That makes this work personal for me. I see it as a ministry. In addition to teaching and working as a school psych, I've worked in several school districts as special ed director, where I've worked to ensure that people with disabilities have equal access to high-quality learning experiences, just as their non-disabled peers. Simply put, I work to make sure that we were enabling students. We were not enabling students, but we were building bridges for them to get from one point to the other. I'm honored to be here tonight and look forward to our discussion.
Thank you so much. And I'm so glad that we have so far two folks who are sharing both personal experiences as well as professional experiences. So thank you very much. Candace Strickland, who I've had the pleasure of working with a little bit myself. So Candace, would you introduce yourself and give a little bit about your background and the lens you bring to this discussion? Let's see. I'm going to make sure Candace is there.
Candace, could you please unmute yourself? Thank you.
Thank you. I forgot that little red line right there. I am currently a professor at Montgomery College teaching mathematical reasoning in the mathematics education program to teachers and a teacher training, to students in a teacher training program. I also teach reading processes and reading acquisition. I've recently retired from Montgomery County Public Schools, where I was a special educator serving in the capacity from birth through 21 through the transition to adult services process. And then I also spent the last 6 years in central office training special education teachers in a variety of ways and strategies to implement and monitor the IEP. I worked at the Clarksburg Correctional Facility for a year, and that had a heavy impact on me because I was hired to teach English. But every single one of my students was an African-American male and had an IEP. So that changed me greatly in my field. I also presented at the National Black Child Development Institute and the National Council of Teachers on Mathematics on mathematical discourse for the struggling math learner. And I'm also the parent of a child who actually she'll be 28 in August, but she was born into the special ed system and aged out in the Maryland public school system when she was 22. So I bring a variety of perspective to this meeting.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much, Candace, for that. Cheryl Poe is our next panelist. Please introduce yourself and share a little bit about your background, please. And don't forget to unmute yourself, Cheryl.
And that's exactly what I did at first, right? Hello, I'm really excited about being here on this panel. So my name is Cheryl Poe, and I am a special education advocate. I got into this work because my children, my now son, who is 25, had some learning difficulties. And as an African-American parent, I really struggled with being able to find resources, supports, or even anyone that looked like me that could provide information and emotional support on that experience. I am a member of the Alliance Against Restraints and Seclusion. I am their diversity team director. I'm also the founder and owner of Advocating for Kids, which is a special education nonprofit that provides support to parents of families with disabilities with a special focus on Black and Brown families in the state of Virginia. And then I'm also the president for a national parent-driven organization called National Allies of Parents for Special Education, NAPSE. And what we do, our mission is to help ensure that quality and accurate information is provided to parents that come from underserved populations and demographics, that your Black and Brown students, along with your lower socioeconomic students, and making sure that those families are accessing quality information for their children, but also advocates, attorneys, and service providers that provide services to that group to ensure that they are understanding the differences that exist. And I too grew up with an IEP. I'm an adult with ADHD and had some specific learning disabilities that I think really helped give me an interesting perspective when I'm working with my clients, when I'm working with families, when I'm working with children, because I can kind of relate to, you know, some of their resistance, avoidance, or even behaviors. So I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
Excellent. We are excited to have you. So thank you, Cheryl. Celine Almazan, do you mind introducing yourself and a little bit about your background?
All right. Thank you so much for inviting me. I appreciate it. My name is Celine Almazan, and I'm the legal director for the Council of Parent Attorneys and Advocates. We are a 2,600 member organization of parents and the attorneys and advocates who support parents and their children with disabilities. We offer training, and we offer annual conferences and webinars. We do extensive training for special education advocates and new attorneys. We also do a fair amount of federal and state policy work on the Hill and in local state governments with our members in each state. In addition to that, the issue of equity has been something that has been on our radar screen for quite some time. We were plaintiffs in a lawsuit against this administration when they sought to roll back the previous administration's regulations on significant disproportionality, which is about equity and the way that children of color are treated in our public schools. We were successful in that lawsuit, and those regulations went into effect, which means that school districts must provide data on some of these topics that we're talking about today. So the issue of equity is very important to us. So is the issue of restraint and seclusion. We were one of the first organizations that had restraint and seclusion principles for our exhibitors and our sponsors and people that we interact with. In addition to that, I've been a lawyer for over 30 years. I have a small private practice. I continue to represent families. A significant number of my clients are people of color. And I represent families in least restrictive environment issues in the state of Maryland, primarily Prince George's and Montgomery County and Anne Arundel County. I'm also a parent. My two adult sons, one had an IEP, one had a 504 plan in Montgomery County, actually. So I know what it is like to walk that walk and how scary it can be. But thank you very much for inviting me.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I'm hoping that our participants in this discussion are as sort of enthused as I am, because I think this is a perfect blend of panelists who have both personal experience as well as expertise and just a real passion for helping kiddos with special needs and sensitive to those racial disparities. So without further ado, let us jump right on in to this discussion. I first also want to sort of applaud X Minds for taking this on. There are a number of things going on in our country, in our states, in our cities, and sort of across the globe that are really bringing up this question of race, identity, and how that impacts us as people. And in particular, as a parent of a kiddo with special needs, I often find myself wondering, worrying, and having a lot of anxiety around what that means for my child with special needs as he sort of continues to grow and get into the world. I want to acknowledge that this topic of racial justice and special education is huge. There's a lot to unpack there, and we will not tackle it all tonight. What we have tried to do is sort of pick three different aspects that we felt that we could talk about, at least try to address, and really give our parents, as well as educators who are listening, a new perspective, some information, and some key tidbits to walk away with, some action items as well from this discussion. So with that being said, the three sort of chunks and nuggets that we're going to focus on tonight are identification and representation within the special education system amongst our children and students of color with disabilities. Segregated educational systems and placements, meaning we're talking about least restrictive environment versus the more restrictive environments. And finally, discipline. So before we get to each of those sections, I will just give a little bit of context. And by a little bit, I really mean a little bit, because there's so much data around each of these topics. But we wanted to sort of set the stage and say, yes, a lot of these things have been documented, right? So we want to give you some documentation before we sort of go into those questions. So the first section is around disparities in identification and representation. And we see in the literature and in articles that there are sometimes conflicting information about this, right? So for Black students, when it comes to comparing them to their peers, 40% more often identified as having a disability, so placing them within that special education sort of pipeline. 2 times more likely to be identified with emotional disturbance and or intellectual disabilities, and often have untreated needs. For our Native American students, they're more likely than their peers, 70% more likely to be identified as having a disability, 2 times more likely to be identified as having learning disabilities, and 4 times more likely to be identified as having developmental delays. Yet on the flip side, there seems to be an underrepresentation in some aspects in terms of early intervention services and early childhood special education. What's even more interesting is that the disproportionality has not been shown to be equated with socioeconomic status. We know that IDEA requires states to report disproportionality, and in 2013, 22 states didn't report any disparities at all. So there's some conflicting information out there. We know that we have a higher representation within special education settings, and then other ways some of that information is a little more conflicting, right? So some questions for our panelists. The first, we've seen that the data sort of shows some of these disparities and disproportionality of having students of color in special education classrooms and settings. If this is true, what factors could possibly be at play to produce? I do want to remind just our participants, if you can, so that we can leave the open microphones to our panelists. That would be great. Thank you so much. But so if these discrepancies are true, what factors are at play that produce this result, and which factors particularly resonate with you and why? And so that's to our panelists. I think Dr. Stewart mentioned you might want to speak to this one, and anyone else can chime in as you're available. Just don't forget to unmute your microphone when you.
Thank you so much for this question. It's a very important one. And interestingly enough, I looked for data today, and it was all over the map. But I'll go with this. In 2018, 2,730,000 students were in special education were minorities, compared to 3,092,000 white students between ages of 6 and 21. This can be put in perspective when considering Hispanics made up 20.41% of the school age population, African Americans made up 17.13% of the population, and white students made up 56.42% of the population. Broken down even further into specific learning categories, minority students comprise 51.4% of the students with intellectual disabilities, the old mental retardation classification, versus 48.59% white, and Black and brown children tended to outrun white peers in emotional disturbance, but white students were found to be more prevalent in under the developmental delay category. In interpreting the possible reasons for this overrepresentation of minorities in special education, there are 4 potential causes that are typically cited. The first is there's a higher proportion of minorities in need of special ed. That's a racial microaggression. I cringe. Teachers disproportionately refer students to be assessed. Teachers tend to over-refer students of color to child study teams. Once referred, we argue that test and assessment tools are biased toward minority students. And we have to just be honest and admit that the system of American public education wasn't set up for students of color. So putting all of that together, we don't have a fighting chance, honestly, in the current structure of education to not get more students of color in special education. I tend to talk a little louder than my peers, or I tend to be a little more active. And I'm quickly referred to a child study team for an assessment to be conducted. We always teach children to do math, to read, to swim, to drive, but we never teach them to behave. So that tends to explain why we find so many students of color with an emotional disturbance eligibility ruling. And when parents are filling out the forms, when teachers are filling out the checklist, we really don't know what they're asking, but for somehow, some way, Black boys end up overpopulating emotional disturbance as a category. So with all of these structures in place from the onset of public education, it was set up for us to overpopulate the disability side of special ed and underpopulate the gifted side of special ed.
I think that you raise a lot of interesting points there, right? Because we certainly want, if a child or if a student needs certain services and actually has a certain disability, we want them to get the services that they need. But I think that the ways in which our children show up in classes may be interpreted in different ways by different educators based on, and race is a factor with that. So it's an interesting dichotomy there. Other panelists that want to weigh in on that question? We'll go on to the next one.
Is someone else talking?
No, go ahead, Candace. If that's you, go ahead.
I felt so influenced and moved by everything that was just said. It kind of moves me into the area that I kind of wanted to speak to. So let me know if we're there or not in advice to parents and things that you would look for to kind of balance out the words that were said before, because I can't speak to the truth or not and the experience or not, but the suggestions that each of us as individuals might take to navigate the situation for our own children or whoever we might be advocating for, I think is important. And so one of the things that I wanted to speak to, or two of the things, are the process, because while it's flawed, we have a process and it can be worked. So we need to understand the process for identifying our strugglers. And then we need to know how to analyze the data. Statements were made about the reliability and validity of some of the tests and tools that we use, and I agree. So then that would lend to the process understanding the validity and reliability of the tools that we're using so we can decide if we want to use them or not. Then, you know, the big thing that I advocate for is to, in looking at a student's present level of performance, to decide how they're meeting standard or not. And I speak through the lens of an educator and a special educator, so straighten me out if I need it. But we need to triangulate the data, the student performance data, around the level that we feel the student should be performing at. And we do that by looking at the longitudinal data, which would be assessments taken over time and the trends. We would look at report card data, and we would look at work samples. And I always tell parents that those special work samples that you save for the refrigerator, that you collect, look at them over time, and you see obvious changes in your child's performance. But it's that kind of performance, or that kind of data, that will lend to progress over time. The other thing we need to look at when we're looking at how our students are managing the curriculum, and I speak again from the Montgomery County lens, that's where I house myself the last 20 years. Let's take a look at the intervention data. And the alignment with the intervention data to the actual need. You can have a reading need and be in a comprehension intervention program, but actually your reading need is word study or phonics. So this is how we have to work together as parents, as teachers, as paraeducators, as administrators, because this discussion that I'm having right now with you, it took me 20 years to get to this point. So it's not an easy thing. Then the other thing we need to look at is current work samples. Math separate across units of study, and writing and reading over the course of an assignment and over the course of the school year and over the course of time. So when we look at all of these measures over time, intervention, present work samples, it triangulates the student's present level of performance for us as measured to a valid and or reliable curriculum, assessment, whatever that standard is. And then if it's not a pretty equilateral triangle, this is the key, then we have to talk and we have to have some uncomfortable discussions, and maybe the intervention has to be questioned, maybe the training has to be questioned, maybe the alignment has to be questioned. But this is where I think, Dr. Stewart, that we are in education, is we recognize that we don't have these valid, reliable resources, but when we collect these samples over time and across levels and across content areas, and we have that courageous conversation, then we can drill down to the authentic present level of performance and plan to that end. And I know that sounds like a perfect little world, but I've actually done it across settings, and I have some amazing people that I can just go by the seat of my pants and say, hey, don't forget to talk multiple meanings of the word bank. And then all of a sudden I have this language lesson that's kind of covered for me. Did I ramble? I didn't mean to ramble if I did.
And I'd like to kind of jump in there a little bit too. Kim, I know this was one of the questions we said that I would cover also. So my perspective is totally different. I'm not an educator. I'm only in this field because as an African-American parent of a Black male student with a disability, we were discriminated against. And there were no resources out there from people that looked like me to help me navigate this situation. So my responses are going to be more geared to, as a Black parent who's been through all of this, what are some of the things that I learned from my experience? And I think one of the things that we need to be very careful with our language, if we are talking with our African-American community about systems that need to be changed or interventions that we need, that they can use, that we need to be clear that we're using language that they can comprehend and understand and then go back and implement to the IEP team. So, you know, I loved your examples, definitely, that are from a professor kind of perspective. But I want to lend voice and make space to a more kind of personal, authentic experience that parents that needs to have space in this conversation. So I think a parent should start and can start with meeting with the teacher, calling a simple teacher-parent conference meeting. And before you have that meeting, you yourself as the parent, you take stock, right, in what you know your child can do and can't do. Your child comes home with homework every single day, so you know what the struggles are, either around attention, motivation of task, understanding the content, maybe understanding the content, but not understanding how to implement what is being required of you. So take stock of what it is you see as a struggle, right? They may be contacting you because they see something, but take stock in what you're seeing also. I talk, again, Dr. Stewart, from a perspective of our kids may need that support. The other piece is, you know, at that meeting, when we say look at the data, what do we mean? What do we mean when we say look at the data? There are several different ways in which the school district measures or makes the final decision as if your child is progressing in the way that they should towards the general education setting. So, you know, I be clear on what kinds of results. Is it your high stakes testing results that your child is not performing on well? And are they trying to throw your child into special ed so they can get their numbers up and get their funding, right? Is it other like benchmark tests, meaning tests that everyone in the district gets to kind of measure the pace of where the child is in the curriculum? is, and then tease the specific area of weakness out that the child may have and have a discussion. And then there's something called universal design, which I think is wonderful, but I don't believe educators have a really good understanding of it, nor do I believe they use it effectively. So, you know, that's the idea of saying, hey, I'm going to differentiate. I'm going to educate my kids based on the level that they are in the classroom. So why does a child, especially an African-American child, have to go through the process of getting special education services if perhaps they just need the attention, a little bit more attention, and checking in, the teacher checking in to make sure that they understand, that the child understands what's being expected of them? Why can't we have general accommodations that allow for prioritizing tasks? So I think those are some conversations that the parent should have with the teacher that's making the referral at first. And then, you know, I'm not against comprehensive testing. I think that there is there are tests nowadays that they are truly validating to make sure that they're culturally competent. That's something that happened about 4 or 5 years, that a lot of the updated tests have a piece where they can say the test has been validated across races and populations, so that we don't have what we had in California years ago, where the test was so faulty that kids were being pushed into a particular category. And I think more importantly, if you're going to get an evaluation, ask about the cultural competency of the examiner that's actually giving the test, right? If you are in a school district that's predominantly white, more than likely you're not going to have a person of color doing the psychological testing. But you can still request, have they been trained about the cultural competency pieces when it comes to interacting with African Americans? And if they aren't, you know, use that power of that independent education evaluation, right, that IEE, to find someone who is, once the results of whatever the school district has done. And the last thing is parents need to understand you have a right to say no. I disagree that my child needs special education services. And instead, I'd like to try something else first. And a Section 504 plan is something that is a tool, that is a law that provides for accommodation, some of those universal design things that you often see, but there's a requirement that that has to be followed. And then also your related services can be provided even in on your Section 504. And that's something that school personnel fail to tell our parents over and over and over again. What other kinds of things can we do for your child first if they don't agree to the special education services? So
I'm hearing that we as parents have options and we have a voice in this discussion, which is, I think, a very key us to walk away from this talk with.
One key thing I kind of want to just put out there about one thing, and that is cultural competence of psychologists, and two, the right to an IEE. A parent does have a right to get an independent evaluation if the parent disagrees with the report. But so I don't want people walking away thinking that I can just come in and get an IEE. It doesn't happen that way. You know, school psychologists as a profession, we embrace cultural competence. We have a course specific to understanding cultural differences of individuals. So the expectation that our national organization actually puts out there is that each school psychologist who holds that credential meets criteria for cultural competence. So I wouldn't want you to go in to a district and say, this is a white psychologist who doesn't understand black and brown kids. And we don't get the right to choose. The law only gives us the right to for the district to give us a qualified examiner. And I have gotten that kind of pushback in my district administration.
Yeah, and those are very good points. There are processes that you kind of have to go through. But I do think that the parent does have a right to have that discussion with the examiner and be very clear about their concerns and expectations around that. if nothing else, for documentation purposes, right?
So thank you all for that. And in the interest of time, I want to kind of piece together a couple of things from that second and last question. So we had a question around advice to parents, and you guys have started talking about that already, but I want to think about sort of when a parent first gets, and this is again from my personal experience too. So when a parent first gets or has that first conversation around, there may be some things going on, there may be a need for extra support, and starts on that sort of diagnosis journey, it's not always the easiest path to walk, right? And for a number of reasons. And one of those things has to do with stigma. And stigma can come up in a couple of different ways. So one of those ways is that I don't want my kid to be labeled, right? Because, oh no, then that has implications for, maybe that carries with them some sort of a bad scarlet letter of some sort with them throughout their educational career. And on the other side, there are cultural implications, right, around how we as different communities of color may perceive, may accept certain diagnoses and things like that. And so the question I wanted to ask around that is, what advice would you give a parent when they first get that heads up, or they have a, an inkling themselves, that in that first moment, before you know about the process and before we're working through all of that, but what's your advice there to sort of deal with, acknowledge the stigma that inevitably we have to wrestle with as parents?
Well, you have to take care of yourself.
I'll start.
Go ahead, Celine.
Thanks. When we met yesterday to go over some of these questions, I look at it from another perspective. I think I said that I represent families of color a lot, and many of them are non-native English speakers. So they have that, in addition to cultural stigma. In my experience, having done this for over 30 years, if a family has an accent, if a family speaks a different dialect, there is not a lot of understanding at an IEP team table about that. And that in and of itself is stigmatizing, because there are assumptions made based upon a lack of English skills, either by the parents or by the children, that permeate an IEP team. And that really is about the construct, right, of how we are set up as a society, right? So you look very other. And I can say that because I was, in 1965, we moved to Asheville, North Carolina, and I didn't speak any English. And so I remember what it feels like to feel other, right? So I think that the stigma is not just in the culture that the families may bring to the table, but it's also that the way that they're made to feel at that IEP team table. And education, special education language, is a language nobody talks like this, right? And so it's very confusing. And when you add on to that, the interpreters, it's very important to have a real interpreter at an IEP team table. It is not the ESOL teacher. It is not the building services guy. It is a real interpreter. And then there has to be an understanding that just because you might be from a Middle Eastern country and you speak Egyptian, not everybody over there is speaking the same dialect. And it's the same thing with Spanish. Not everybody from every country speaks the same sort of Spanish. And so I think that for families going into this, whether it's that I don't understand why my child's not making progress, if you don't have an interpreter there to help you, if they're bringing somebody in because, you speak Spanish, that's not acceptable. And it really does set up a stigmatization going into it for families, setting aside the cultural issues that families might already bring to the table.
That's a great point. I think someone else had wanted to chime in too, on that note. Around.
That was one of my questions yesterday too. As a person of color, sitting in meetings, I'm always reminded that, especially in the Southern Black family, when we had people with mental illness, we just pushed them to the back room and don't come out when company comes, and we never talk about them. That same stigma comes over in special ed. I don't want that label on my child. It's a harsh label. One thing I tell parents when we get to the table, though, special ed is so different today than it was when I was in school or when you were in school. Today, the goal is to include that student alongside the non-disabled peers to the fullest extent possible. That means that we're going to bring services to that student in that classroom alongside that non-disabled peer. So it is hard work getting parents to understand that labels aren't a bad thing, and special ed is not a place, it's a set of services and supports to help the student. We build bridges to connect students and empower students. But that is a very hard conversation. It's something that we as a profession will continue to have to fight. Because especially in the African-American community, that's just something we don't talk about. It's hard, it's harsh. But so the more we can get the word out that it's not so bad, it's not a place, but it supports and services to get them to get that student to reach full and maximum potential.
Excellent, that's a great point. So I think that's a nice segue for us to get off and or get over into the next sort of topic, but I do want to just check in with our panelists if there's any final words that anyone wanted to say. I don't want to leave any sort of cliffhangers for you all.
I just saw a comment that someone had a question about the IEE that I want to clarify. The cost of the IEE, if you do it, with the law says that the school district will definitely evaluate your child first. And if you disagree with the results of the evaluation, if you feel it wasn't comprehensive, but for some reason it didn't give you the information that you need, you can request an IEE, and that will be at public expense. So I just wanted to clarify that process.
Thank you so much. So the next section of this discussion is around educational placements. Right. So we know that IDEA calls for students to be in the least restrictive environment, you know, when appropriate and as possible. Yet in 2014, this study showed that children of color with disabilities were in regular education settings less than 40% of the day. So that meant 17% of Black students with disabilities were in that less than 40% of the day in regular education, 21% of Asian students with disabilities, 11% of Native American, and then 11% of white students were not meeting that requirement of really being in the least restrictive environment. And so we have a number of questions around that piece. And the first one is really around, you know, we really say we've already gotten, you know, our diagnosis or we're in services. What are some signs for parents to be on the lookout for, and also for educators, right? Because we have educators on this call as well. So what are some signs that a placement might be too restrictive for a particular student? And for this one, I had a note that Celine and Candace may want to speak on this one.
You want to go first, Candace?
I'll, if you don't mind, I'll start, and let's back and forth if we need to. This is really a rich discussion. I can't thank you all enough. But when I'm looking at placement data for a student, I'm looking at the academic data, and I'm looking at behavioral data. My guess is if we're questioning the placement, those two areas are both areas of concern. And what I would look for, and I would say this to educators and parents, is the discontinuous data, choppy data. It can be every other Wednesday or a Monday of 1 week, a Thursday of the next week, and over settings and over multiple service providers. And the reason I feel like I can say this is that I was that one teacher it wasn't the child that had the problem. I was the one that needed to make the change. So when you're looking at student performance and you're looking at a change of placement for educators and parents as well, we're looking at weekly and daily data around academic performance and around behavioral performance across multiple settings and multiple service providers. And then you want to see what trends over, you have a discontinuous grading period, so that's 9 weeks. You collect data every other week or 5 days, 1 week, take a week off, but it'll show a trend over time. And then that becomes a discussion point for, is the placement too restrictive or not? And the law supports the least restrictive environment. So that's where we should start. And then we need to look at the data that says it should change. And we need to look at the data and analyze the data much more than we do. So that's what I wanted to say, Celine.
I have something. Can I add something to that about the data? So I keep hearing you guys talk about the data. So I'm going to speak from the clinician standpoint and the autistic individual standpoint. The data, I've worked in Anne Arundel County, Baltimore City, and Montgomery County. I've never seen data that's not skewed. There's observer drift. They're not collecting it appropriately. They haven't been trained to collect it appropriately. So you're working off the data, which ideally would be beautifully and accurate if the data were correct. But the problem is the teachers are not taking it correctly, or there is implicit bias that is there that they've already made up their mind that things are not going to work with that child, and they kind of haphazardly take data. And it's just not that easy. Like, we wouldn't be here if it was just like the data was, you know, the problem is teachers need to be trained in taking the data in order to be accurate. You can't have an accurate intervention if you have inaccurate data. And in terms of assessments, I kind of wanted to say that is a part of data. And being an autistic individual and somebody who was non-vocal for 12 years of their life, I know that a lot of these tests are based on verbal behavior. So there's nothing wrong with these psychometric testing. They're accurate and valid when they're given to individuals that know how to maneuver through verbal behavior. But if you have deficits in verbal behavior, then that's not going to be accurate either. So it's great to rely on this data. And I have, you know, like, psychology is my thing, and I have so much, you know, faith and belief in it, but it has to be accurate in order for it to reflect accurate intervention. And so the reason it's that not that easy is because teachers are not trained in doing so. And I think maybe teachers need to gather together and, you know, rally to ask their administrators, can they get some better training on taking, you know, better data so they can have better results in terms of the intervention. But it has always been disturbing to me when I look at data and I'm like, what is this? And then stuff is not operationally defined. Different people are implementing things and things are not implemented with fidelity. When I was working as a behavior specialist, I would drop in surprisingly and kids would not have the tools and resources they would have, and they weren't even implementing interventions with fidelity. So the data is skewed, you know, so we got to fix that and make sure that there's a way to come in and fix that.
So I absolutely agree with you. And the very nature of this discussion is shifting the analysis as we speak. If I were to frame this in the scope of an IEP meeting and you brought one data point that told me the critical need in language that you just expressed to me yourself, and that would influence every other data point that we were looking at. So I think that we have a lot to overcome, and we are working on a lot. And I think that these discussions, this exact moment in time, is exactly what we need to carry forward. Because I feel my own thinking being influenced left and right. And even in this conversation, I feel like I'm advocating for someone with a language need. And, you know, so while everything that you're saying is true, I also think that we can go forward on this with
the
discussion.
And I also want to bring up too, you can't address the cultural competency of somebody being able to deal with a child as Black and also addressing the cultural competency of dealing with autistic individuals. We have a culture as well that we have different needs, you know, and people try to sometimes frame us and analyze it based on neurotypical needs, and it's not the same, you know? So that is also a problem in being culturally competent. You need to be culturally competent in knowing what autistic values culture is, knowing that joint attention doesn't mean eye contact, knowing what that means for the autistic culture. So that's my piece.
and also knowing what direct eye contact means to adult in that particular demographic, right? Because there's some demographics, if your child's staring you in the eye like that, that's a sign of disrespect, right? So you have to merge the two together.
Absolutely. I do want to ask a follow-up question.
Can I just say one thing? What I wanted to add, what I think is kind of missing from this, is that from a parent's perspective, a parent knows in their gut when something is not right. And that's how they know that something is too restrictive, or they know in their gut that the data is not being taken, or they know in their gut that there is, that it's not being taken with fidelity. And so, you know, from going all the way back to the beginning of the question, you know, parents know. And then once the parent knows, then we have to help them as advocates to figure out how do you build your argument that this is too restrictive? What are the things that we need to show so that we know that you know, the data is not being taken with fidelity, there's no data, they're skewing the data. But in, you know, my experience, and also as a parent, you just know when something is not right. I think we have to give a voice to that, because lots of times parents feel so powerless at an IEP team, because like I said, it's very jargony. There's a lot of people that are sitting there that are educators with a lot of initials after their names. Mm-hmm. And a parent just knows what they know, because they know their child the very best out of everybody. So I just wanted to...
I agree, Celine. We're not the experts. The parent and the child are the experts. And I always tell them that. I'm not the experts. You guys are the experts. I'm just here to help you facilitate what they need to do. But I completely agree with that.
And what do you do also when you have like the parent walking into a room, it's the only African-American person or the only... And there's no one at that table, a part of that discussion, that looks like you or your child. I take issue with that too, because then there's definitely a lens, right? These educators are coming from a lens of privilege, I think, a lot of times, versus understanding the reality of what a Black family or child would have to, what they are going through in these processes.
Perfect. So that was the follow-up question was around, well, what about the parent voice, right? And so how does a parent really know, right? If you're not an expert in that assessment, how does a parent really know that it's not being done with fidelity? And I think that point, Celine, that you brought up about your gut and then knowing your child is huge. It's a huge thing. So thank you for that. The final question in this particular group of questions is around, so if we're supposed to have our students and advocate for them being in the least restrictive environment, what accommodations are actually appropriate and can be put in place? And from personal experience, I've had discussions about this, battles, if you will, around, oh, well, if you need this particular accommodation, then you have to go to a different environment. So I would love to open that up. And I know a number of you wanted to talk about that, so I will let you jump in.
Okay, I think I said I'd talk about it. So I think it's important to start with defining the language, right? What is LRE? What is least restrictive environment? So I always encourage parents to come from a lens of, my child can be in the least restrictive environment, which means that's the educational environment where they will have access to general education peers along with the general education curriculum, right? So the more time they're in a setting where they are having a general education teacher provide instructions along with maybe a support of a special education teacher and general education students in the classroom, that's what you start with. What can be pushed in to help that child stay in that particular environment? And then modifications and accommodations, school people get this wrong all the time. There's a difference between a modification and an accommodation. A modification changes instruction. It changes curriculum. It alters the content of instruction. And it has a different level of performance expectation, a lower level of performance of student expectation than it would if you have an accommodation. So your accommodations support, right, the child in being able to complete the task in the general education setting without modifying content, without lowering expectations. So I think when we start there as a basis for parents to look at, is the educational setting that my child in beneath what I know he can do? Are they changing his curriculum, modifying his curriculum so much that there's no way where you can see that they'll catch up? I think some of the major accommodations that parents should always, depending on the disability, there are hundreds of accommodations that I think a parent can ask for. They really are. And I recommend that parents, again, get to know your child. How do they learn best? And they can, and I think that related services are totally underutilized in the Black community. I find historically all the time, I can be representing a white family and they'll have assistive technology devices and iPads and software programs presented. I go into IEPs with people of color and it's like pulling teeth to identify why haven't you evaluated this child for some assistive technology devices to help them, to assist them in accessing the general education curriculum. There are counseling supports and services that can be provided to address any kind of trauma a child may be having in school to help with behavioral concerns that may have come up, to address disabilities that are around mental health issues. So I think in addition to accommodations, we need to pair it with related services, things that are out there, parent training. It might be very instrumental to request that someone come in and do an observation of the teacher's management of the classroom, especially if you notice that your child is being suspended, restrained, excluded, any of those negative behaviors that happen to our kids often, because it could be the environment, it could be a teacher's bias. So I think with the accommodations, the key piece, instead of me rambling off a list of 5,000 things, is what does this child need? What kind of support? Is it a calculator that they need to be able to stay in that general education classroom and do the work required?
Thank you. I saw Candace wanted to sort of jump in, so I'll go ahead and call.
I agree with what you're saying, Cheryl, but through the lens of narrowing it down to a conversation with the teacher about the content at the fourth grade level in mathematics, I think if we look at all the accommodations listed in state assessments, teachers and parents should be familiar with those and implementing those throughout content areas and across educational settings. And then I think that we need to be familiar with accommodations and modifications and different levels of support with the different curriculum that we're using. For example, when do we use the calculator accommodation? And when do we use a read-to accommodation? What are we measuring? So I think that if we, because there are 500 of them, but it still is a finite list. There's going to be certain ways we support reading comprehension versus word study and number systems and algebraic reasoning and math. It'll be two ways of managing. So I think if we're looking for how to support any level of struggler in the least restrictive environment, we are talking about a universal design for learning. So I kind of want to link back to that because I heard someone mention that, and that's a whole discussion in and of itself. But if we're looking at the accommodations that every student receives, not just every accommodation available, but we're going kind of in that FAPE area, we're talking about the appropriateness of the service. And if it's something that we're providing for every student, then we should provide it for every student. And if it's something that's aligned with Eureka Math, then every student learning Eureka Math should get the accommodation. Does that kind of make sense? It helps in the discussion when there's a problem. If we're aligning our student need with our curriculum and with our ultimate goal, does that I know I'm teacher talking, and I apologize for that.
That kind of goes outside the scope of the requirements of IDEA, right? The idea that we want to limit accommodations to what's based on the curriculum or what's allowed on the high stakes testing, I think is short-sighted, and I think it denies children opportunities to look at other ways to learn how to compensate and learn. I think that is not, when we are basing it on, again, other factors other than the unique needs of that individual child, we are not meeting the standard of FAPE, which is to look and identify supports and services that meet the unique needs of that child under their circumstance based on their disability. So I kind of disagree.
I totally agree, Cheryl. I want to jump up out of my chair and jump through the ceiling for what you're saying, because we don't do that. We have these blanket reading comprehension, read aloud accommodations. We have these blanket test kids in small settings accommodations that may not even be needed for that kid. The IEP is individualized. Educational program, we often say plan, but it's a program of supports and services. So we have to identify what supports best meet the needs of that kid. And they need them on state tests, they need them every day. If they don't need it every day, we can't just restrict it to, they're only going to use it for a state test. Because if that's the case, they shouldn't be using it because they don't need it.
I appreciate that. I do want to kind of scope this a little bit for our discussion and bring this back to this point around specifically the least restrictive environment, right? Because parents may know and some don't know that sometimes when you're told, okay, this can't be accomplished in the least restrictive environment, sometimes their kid is getting forced into a track that then takes them out of being diploma track too early, right? And so there are some real implications about these placements and what happens. So I'd like to ask again this question around, are there any accommodations, or how empowered can a parent be to ask for certain accommodations based on their individual student and their child in the least restrictive environment? And if you want to talk about that, you know, implication around certificate versus diploma track, go ahead. I just want to make sure that we're touching on that.
Well, I was certificate track. So, of course, you know, this is something that I was certificate track, and now I'm in a PhD program. So that lets you know that education failed me horribly. And I feel like, especially because we can stay in school until we're 21, if you can't help, if you look at the statistics, I think it's 80% of us can graduate, not get a certificate, with proper supports. 80% of us, and this is specifically autistic people. But yet, that's not the percentage of people that are getting it. And we're staying in school an extra 4 years. So if you have an extra 4 years, why can't you help me to get whatever accommodations I need? I don't feel like, and I could be biased because, you know, this is a struggle that I went through, but I had to stay in school until I was 21, didn't get a GED until I was 26. Also because I believed what I was told. And that the harm in that alone was, you know, you always overhearing that you can't achieve things. But I really think parents should not be afraid. I don't think there should be like anything, unless it's like absolutely insane. I think that you really have to be creative and ask for those accommodations, and just don't let them put your child on certificate track without really making sure, because there's no future. What is going to school for no diploma? You can't, if your parents aren't wealthy, you're going to be poor. You're going to be unemployed. You know, like there's nothing you can do without that. So you need to fight as hard as you can. For teachers, you know, sometimes I feel like it's just another child, but this is our life. And so fight for it. If you got to ask for accommodations that they've never seen, do what you got to do. Because that's just how I feel as somebody who had to spend their life, you know, literally what I call fighting for my life. And so if I would have had the accommodations that I needed, I learned how to take the GED test from simply putting my study materials into credit form, because I stem from credit form. If a teacher would have figured that out, I could have, you know, like that's something that's not traditional. But if you could have put my learning materials in a scrolling form, that's all I needed. You know, so just kind of push them to think about what they can do creatively. And I feel like accommodations, that's your job. You an educator. I'm sorry. That's just how I feel.
And one of the things that I know parents get told a lot is that they, you know, we can't do that. We're not allowed to do that. And that's usually not the truth. Or even that guilt trip. You know, I would love to do it, but I got 30 other two students in my class and I can't do that for everyone. That is putting, parents, if you're out there, do not accept that. That is not within your, you have a right to ask for the supports that your child needs, and funding and class size is not a factor that should be considered when those requests are being made.
That's right. That's right. The law doesn't say anything about that. You know, the law says you start where you would have attended if you did not have a disability. So that's, you know, there is no accommodation, modification that can't be done in something less restrictive. It's just, it's the way that the service model is set up within school systems, that you congregate everybody in, you know, in one separate set. And I've been calling it this for years, a segregated classroom, because that's what it is. It's segregation. And, you know, what Joy said about low expectations, you know, it is, as W said, you know, low, soft bigotry of low expectations for kids. And, you know, that's probably the only thing I ever agreed, but I, you know, he was right. You know, it is the soft bigotry of low expectations for kids. You know, when my oldest son was identified, the special education teacher told me, Celine, he'll never be a lawyer. He'll never go to college. And we'll be lucky if we get him out of high school with a high school diploma based on an IQ score and based on a disability. Well, you know what? He did graduate from high school. He went on to college, graduated from college, got into 9 colleges, and is a successful person doing what he can do, even though he's got this lifelong disability that impacts him greatly. But he's, you know, he's married and he's happy and he's got a life. But if I'd listened to them, that never would have happened.
I think in tying all of that back to that question we asked before about stigma, I think that some of these success stories, even if they didn't happen along the same typical trajectory and timeline, but that there are lots of possibilities, right? And that the sort of the distance doesn't define the outcome. And that I appreciated all of your discussion around empowering parents to ask for accommodations, even in that least restrictive environment, and making sure they're individualized for their kiddos, and sort of pushing for that. And then also, I mean, I'm also a former educator, so encouraging and supporting our educators to sort of think outside the box to go along that journey with us. So I appreciate all of that discussion. But it is time to move on to the next section, so I do want to go ahead and do that. This next part that we wanted to talk about is loaded. It's concerning discipline, okay? And so in a single year, for some context, between 2013 and 2014, 1 in 5 Black, Native American, and multiracial boys with disabilities was suspended on the sort of national level. And students with disabilities were 2 times more likely to receive school suspension across the board and across ethnicities. Black students, boys, and those with disabilities were disproportionately disciplined regardless of the type of discipline, level of school poverty, and type of school. But what about girls with disabilities? There's also, and thanks to Cheryl for this, there's also some great research around girls of color with disabilities. And so we found that females with disabilities, amongst other things, were often given insufficient attention because sometimes they are able to mask things a little bit better or not stand out as much. But then also having disproportionate suspension rates in accordance with their race and ethnicity. So Asian girls had the least rate of suspension there at 3.8, followed by white girls, then Latina girls, Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander girls at 13.3%, Native American girls at 13.9%, Black girls at 18.6%, and multiracial girls at 21.3%. So we are seeing some discipline sort of trends come up along these racial lines, and it's something that we hear about and see in the news a lot, so it's on a lot of our minds. So when it comes to the questions here, there are a couple of different things that we've talked about and we want to mention. So there's seclusion, there's restraint, suspensions, and expulsions. And just to sort of ground that conversation, I would love if we could sort of discuss kind of what these things are, what they sort of mean. And then if there are any key takeaways that you would like to give our audience of parents and educators about their youth within school systems. So if you had any one particular thing to say about, we could start there.
I think this is one of the questions that I got voluntold. Let me start with, and I'm speaking now as a school psychologist, but I want to be specific to say that suspension is never an intervention. Suspension is never an intervention. That's the takeaway that I want everyone to leave with. And I say that because, I said this a few minutes ago, that we teach students to read, we teach students to do math, we teach students to swim, we teach students to drive, but we punish students when they misbehave. We never teach the expected behavior. And what's new in the whole RTI framework, it was named a little more explicitly, was the behavior component. And then we just called, we gave it a new name and called it MTSS. But just as we teach reading and math, we have to teach behavior. And in the IEP, we are required by law to address academics in the area of reading and math, transition, so post-secondary transition, and behavior. If any one of those three impede a child's ability to access or participate in the general ed curriculum, despite what the disability category is, we have to address. So I start with that. That's the big takeaway. Seclusion and restraints are something that we do not support. I do support seclusion in a kind of way, but that kind of way is I remove you for a cool down, for a timeout, but then there's a teaching component. I teach you the appropriateness or the pro-social behavior is what we call it, and then I return you to the setting. What we end up doing, though, in practice, we end up moving a student out of the general ed classroom, and we're changing their LRE without getting the parent's permission. The parent, well, not permission, but making the parent aware that that's what we're doing. And we do it under the guise of he couldn't or she couldn't self-regulate at this time, so I moved her. No, we just changed LRE without an IEP committee decision. Suspensions and expulsions. If there's a pattern of behavioral concerns, we have to address it. First off, we can take the E word off. I don't know the definition of that word because we don't use that word with my children. We don't expel. I am still guaranteed the same level of supports and services that I would have gotten if I were not suspended or expelled. Suspensions. I tell schools this all of the time. I've been a special ed director, I've been a school psychologist, and I always tell principals, you got 10 days to treat them in the fate-free 10. When we get past the 10, they're not going home again. So if you want to go ahead and suspend 10 days in August, that's okay. Just know there are 8 more months of school. And I say, what are we going to do to address the behavior? And we tend to get it right in academics. We tend to get it right in reading intervention and math intervention, but we struggle so much with behavior intervention and actually teaching the expected behavior. So that's another takeaway. Where's the behavior intervention plan? Where are the functional behavior assessment where we actually know or hypothesize why the kid may be acting out? Because if you keep suspending me and I don't want to go to Ms. Jones' English class anyway because I can't read, you know what? I know what to do. I'm winning because I'm gonna go in and act out. She's gonna send me to the office, and you're gonna suspend me, and I've gotten what I want. I've avoided something that I can't do. So we have to address behavior in a way that we address reading and math. We have to teach the expected behavior, give the kids the skills to self-regulate in the classroom.
Dr. Stewart, do you mind? I was trying to interject when you were talking because I think you made a very great point. I think there's often theory and then what happens in practice, right? And sometimes in practice, we either fall short or something else is going on. So if you don't mind, why do you think we get it wrong in practice? Right? If the theory is to go ahead and remove and have it be a teachable moment, what's happening in practice that makes that difficult? I think that will be important for us to understand.
Because the expectation is that I come to school knowing how to behave, and I don't. because you and I come from different backgrounds, and what's considered pro-social or normal at your house is not pro-social or normal at my house. So this is how, or we make mountains out of molehills. Johnny gets up every 5 minutes. Johnny may have hyperactivity, issue with impulsivity and hyperactivity. So guess what? Put him in the back of the class and put him on a regulator to say, you get up every 3 minutes, every 5 minutes, whatever that individual needs, you stand up, stretch, burn the energy, and sit back down in a way that's not disruptive. So it just takes us thinking outside the box to educate children. That's why it's individual.
Can I take you back, him?
Yes.
And then I want to jump in.
I feel like he's making a strong point on, we're not teaching any replacement behavior. All of those things are all punishment procedures, right? From a clinical definition, a punishment procedure should reduce the unwanted behavior. But if somebody keeps getting suspended for the same thing, then if you want to look at it, an intervention, that is not working because it's not reducing it. And in fact, what he's saying is, a lot of the time, kids find school aversive, and then they get reinforced from the suspension, and then that leads them down a whole nother rabbit hole. You know, so...
Joy, you're preaching.
It's not effective in any way. And right. I just really don't understand why, okay, if you're repeatedly suspending somebody, okay, then that's not an effective quote-unquote intervention because it's not decreasing the behavior. You have to teach a replacement skill. You have to teach what he's saying. You know, like, you have, they're not learning anything from that. You know, so I just wanted to, like, I really like what you were saying. You got me all hyped.
And I just want to chime in because I agree with everything you all, to what you all say. And let's then add the lens of color, right? All of that. And then let's add the lens that Black boys are seen and viewed differently by white women specifically than they are by Black women. And that becomes, I think, one of the main issues. We cannot talk about, and I'm just going to say, we cannot talk about restraint, seclusion, expulsions without talking about institutional racism that exists within our public schools.
Name
that
it.
Allow this to occur.
They confuse deviance with deficits all the time. Like, well, deficits with deviance. So somebody might have a social deficit, mm-hmm. but because they're Black, they'll get referred to a disciplinary board.
Exactly.
The same child as white would be referred to an assessment. And I see right. it all the time, unfortunately, in Baltimore public schools. You know, like, this child is engaging in exactly, I'm talking about, it could be like the clinical DSM definition of autism. And they'll refer the white child to get an assessment, but the Black right. child will be suspended or put in home and hospital and not receive education. Like, I literally have students that have been put in home and hospital but haven't been seen by anybody.
Yeah. Criminal.
Yeah, me too. I have students that are coming out of the psych hospital, never ever assessed by the school, right?
Yep.
But they'll call CPS, they call juvenile justice, they start that school to prison pipeline on behaviors that are associated with a disability, which is organic, right? Mm-hmm.
It's okay for them to get a diagnosis of some type of mental disorder or behavioral disorder, but it could be clearly like autism staring you in the face. And it's like they tiptoe around all these other things because, you know, oppositional defiance disorder is literally like, okay, we're gonna factor that into the how much we put into building prisons because this mm-hmm. kid is, you know, like. Mm-hmm. So I see it all yeah. the time in Baltimore, and sometimes it's simply where the parent is from. You know, mm-hmm. they're Black, they're from a certain area, and they just yeah. assume, you know, that they have a broken home or, you know, yeah. something is wrong with the parenting. That's another issue mm-hmm. that's always happening yes. to my Black parents. My white yes. parents never get DCFS called on them, but mm-hmm. my Black parents do all the time because something is wrong with their parenting, which is causing the behavioral problems.
Right.
And so that's an issue.
Yeah. And then you have the piece again, even when these things kind of happen, maybe a child does engage in a way that we need to really look at the behaviors and we need to put some supports in there. Are we, again, is that teen? Is it, again, a parent in a room with 10 white folk, again, trying to develop or understand the function of a behavior? Right? So they can miss it on that point because if they don't understand the background or even bother to engage the student when the student is able or the parent in that process of collecting data for the function, you're missing a huge point. You're missing a perspective that you don't have that you can't have. So
I recently encountered a parent, and she's kind of been somebody who we've been talking about this, so she's okay. Like, I'm not, you know, she was autistic herself, 35 years old though, and they viewed her as that irate Black woman with social deviant behavior. But when I met her, I'm like, have you ever been assessed? Gave her the battery of assessments. Her doctor diagnosed her as autistic, you know, but it's like she had been her whole life through that system, and now her kids were going through it, you know, and it's just like, no, they were just ignoring it. I'm like, how is it a whole family that is blatantly like this? And this is something that I've seen more than once, you know. I'm like, how is this happening? And people are just overlooking it, like, oh, she's just loud and unruly. And it's like, have you ever thought about there could be, she can be mentally disturbed, but she can't have autism, or, you know, and that's how they view the kids too. And it just continues.
I think you all have brought up, you know, that unfortunately these things are very prevalent, especially within communities of color, these interventions, but they're not really interventions, right? But so it begs the question, is there ever a time and a place where these are appropriate?
And I think you're going to get different views. So as a parent advocate, parent, 100%, and also part of a, you know, a program called the Alliance Against Restraint and Seclusion, the answer is no. There are so many more options that are out there. There are literally programs. Okay, first of all, we know that kids are dying due to being restrained and secluded. They are literally dying, equal to the public lynching of George Floyd with the knee on the chest when they want to do prone restraints. So it is a, literally you're taking a risk at possibly killing a child. And we've had that in the state of Virginia in one of our schools where a kid was killed being restrained and secluded. And I have a friend of a child who was hospitalized for being put in a seclusion room that was a cell basically, and ended up breaking his foot and his hands. So I say no, but I do say there are times when interventions are needed, and there are programs. There's Dr. Ross Green. He has a whole comfort versus control method. We have the Cura method, which does not put hands on the child, but it does protect the child and the staff by having mats as the child is acting out. The whole time, the group that are around him are just saying, you are okay, you are safe. So you're just escalating the child without putting hands on and making it worse. And I think for suspensions, restorative justice, there's tons of data out there that says the process of restorative justice really does help. You know, the idea that a child does break a rule of conduct, you know, teaching the child about empathy, teaching the child about perspective taking, how does your behavior impact others? That is a much better lesson than you got to go home for 10 days and you get to, you know, do nothing. So I don't personally believe any of them are ever should be used, but our society is an aggressive society, so.
I agree with Cheryl, of course. I was subjected to it. And people also don't realize the trauma that comes with that. I didn't have functional communication until sixth grade, you know, like clear functional communication. And people would assume that they had repaired the relationship or I had recovered. I was terrified to go to school. I spent half of my day worrying about not being put in these situations and kind of tiptoeing around, you know. And what people don't realize is when we're going through these things, these are not personal attacks towards you. These are internal conflicts we're having with ourselves. So part of the things that you need to realize is helping us have the tools to manage them, helping to prevent them by sensory integration when we're having meltdowns. There's a difference between a meltdown and a tantrum, and people often label it a tantrum, and it's not. It's overstimulation. So a lot of times environmental changes, treating the environment and not the person, doing a lot of antecedent interventions to kind of gauge what is triggering it around what time, so you know prior to that to schedule sensory integration breaks, because a lot of times it's surrounding sensory being overstimulated. But a lot of antecedent interventions is what you can use to prevent it. And I think that it's never, ever, like you shouldn't treat a child or human being, you know, like some type of animal. And the way that it feels very demeaning. It feels, you know, they expect for you to recover from it and you don't, and they're in your face the next day. And you know how it feels to to be subjected to that one day, and then the next day somebody is trying to be all nice to you, and especially someone like me who didn't have the ability to communicate these things, and I'm forced to be in that situation because I'm in school, which already is turning into an aversive situation, because now I feel locked with these people that I don't trust. And so I didn't want to be there. You know, so you have to think about how that impedes people learning, because you're worrying about all day about being subjected to seclusion and restraint. And, you know, and I have gotten hurt many times. You know, I'm 43, so a lot of things have changed now, but I got hurt. I've had broken limbs because of that when I was a child. You know, so you have to really think about, and I was an eloper, and I was a naked eloper, you know, but if people would have sat and thought about the reason why I was eloping, and it was sensory issues, you know, like, rather than just reacting, I feel like they're not being as proactive as they should be. So I feel like it never should be implemented.
I feel like that's such an important point, and I appreciate the personal perspective that you bring to it. Not only that, these notions that they're used too often, and that it's traumatizing for the individual. We had started talking about some other alternatives. And so in the interest of time, because we are coming up on our hour and a half, if there are any other alternatives that parents and educators should be aware of, right? We talked about restorative justice, thank you, Cheryl, and some other things, but if there are any other alternatives that you want parents to be aware of, so that, you know, they're not just thinking like, oh, they seclude and restrain in the school and I thought that was the only option. What else should parents know about as we kind of include this part of the discussion?
One of the big things that parents need to know that they're in the federal guideline that was put out for the 15 principles about restraints and seclusions, right? To kind of help states figure out how to put regulatory language around this, because a lot of states don't have it. But there's a piece about having documentation from a medical professional, whether it be an MD or a licensed psychologist kind of person. And that if a parent can show, or if there is a recommendation by one of those individuals saying that the use of restraints and seclusion will cause harm to the child, then restraints and seclusion shouldn't be used on the child. So my recommendation for parents to kind of protect yourselves from that is get a letter from an MD, a licensed professional, and get them to write language about what the harm will be to your child if they're restrained and secluded. But also, more importantly, ask them for alternative ideas on how to handle a situation where your child may be experiencing a sensory meltdown. But of course, we know you got OT, and that's a related service, and all those kinds of things can be put in school. But I think the important piece is protecting your child from being restrained and secluded by having a medical documentation saying, if you do this, it will harm your child in this way. And document that on the IEP.
I want them to make sure they look at the data and ask questions like, see if there's a pattern at what time it's happening. So have you guys put in preventative measures to take a sensory integration break before this happens? Environmental changes, like ask those questions about the data. And just really think about, like, I can't stress to you how horrible, like, I left the country and took my autistic child to Germany for 10 years to go to school because I did not want her to experience what goes on in America. And I know that it can be done without it because my daughter was never subjected.
I just wanted to say, when it came to physical restraints regarding my daughter and her IEP, I just put in her IEP under parent request, parent information, that there should be verbal support only. There should be no physical contact. And then in the IEP at a glance, the document that usually communicates the meat of the IEP to the educational team, I made sure that that element of her IEP was included in her IEP at a glance. And it was followed. It was a request, hands off, words only. It was communicated to the team. And then it got back to me at a time where I thought, why in the world wouldn't someone have given her a hand and helped her up off the floor? And it's because my request was there be no physical contact. And so, you know, it can work, and the information can get into the IEP, and the information can be communicated to the team. And as much as we are surviving in a horrendous process, we do have amazing people that work with our kids. And sometimes it is just getting into the heart and mind of that one person and it could be somebody different every year. And, you know, that you may have non-example years. I'm not saying that everything we're not talking about isn't valid and true. But that common language, that communication piece, and getting into that, you know, that one person can be the change that we need to make for our children.
And you have to.
I've been trying to watch the chat as we moved along, and there are several comments and questions around this issue. And the general theme is school districts won't do this. Get it in the IEP, and then they have to do it. Behavior support is a related service that can go on an IEP. Get it on the IEP and school. One question was, districts say they don't have time to take a break. Again, get it on the IEP and they have to do it. Demand as a parent that this be placed on my child's IEP to address the behavior. Or here is your one pushback. If the school says we can't do it, say, since you can't provide a free appropriate public education for my child, I take it that you will pay for my child an education outside of the school system. It's just that simple. Demand that it goes on the IEP. Once it's on the IEP, then there's no way around it. Several people were asking questions about that, but behavior support is an accommodation or related service that is available to students with disabilities. So make sure you get it on the IEP.
And psychological services, right? That's a related service.
It's a related service.
Also talk to some of these issues.
Right. And make sure it's being done by a credentialed person. Don't go to the teacher. Don't let the IEP teacher be the related service provider for behavior. Get a qualified person. So at minimal, school counselor, school psychologist. If a child has autism and needs ABA therapy, make sure the person is credentialed in ABA. So just like we require that a speech therapist provides the speech services, we also want a credentialed person to provide the behavior support services to the child.
Dr. Stewart. So yes. I got a question. So I have a lot of parents that are poor that I work with.
Mm-hmm.
I do what I can do when I can and I go, but a lot of them are telling me they've made these requests or their mates and they're Black. Because it's only mm-hmm. four Black parents, and they're made to feel like this is something they can't get. You know, like, how do they get a hold of somebody that can advocate, or you know of any advocating services that?
I don't. I'm new to the area. If we were in Mississippi, okay. I would tell you exactly who to call. But I'm new to the area, so
me too. That's why
I don't really know. Southern Poverty Law Center is a big organization that we always use in Mississippi. I'm sure, and they're in other states. I just don't know how far up they come. But we have to, you know, someone just said in the chat, what if the superintendent denies a related service? We have an attorney on here who knows case law. There's a case called Horton versus Doe. You can't unilaterally make a decision about a kid's educational programming who has an IEP. A superintendent can't deny. It's an IEP committee decision. So it's not the superintendent, it's an IEP committee decision. So pushback, and it is good. You know, file due process with your, against the school district. Get a hearing officer involved.
You get a state complaint.
Do a state complaint. That could go to mediation. Demand that your child, and you know, I've been in that room as a quasi parent. My sister, I fought for my nephew who had an IEP through school, and that kid would not be in college today had he not gotten the right programming in his K-12 experience. And there were times my sister would say, "Boy, I hope we don't go to jail today when you go show up in this IEP meeting." And I fight like that for kids when I'm the school administrator. I fight the same way. They're all my kids. But make those demands and know your rights. get advocacy agencies or organizations involved if you can't fight the fight. Because oftentimes you do walk in to a room full of white females who are condescending and make you feel stupid and dumb. And that's not what it's supposed to be about. You have to have a voice in the education of your child with a disability.
And that's kind of what I was trying to say.
There is a location. Like, one second for me, panelists. I just want to honor kind of the time that we're at. This is such a rich discussion. So I can let it go on. And we can go a little longer, but I do want to emphasize a couple of things. So one, to our participants in the chat, we had mentioned earlier for those who came on a little later that we probably weren't going to get to the sort of participant question and answer piece just because of the, it's such a rich discussion as it is, but we are going to be sharing our panel contact information at the end. And so obviously we've already gone over 8:30 and I want to get to our sort of final questions, but if our panelists are so engaged and want to continue on past that, we can. Those of you that need to drop off, feel free to do so. But I do want to continue that conversation. So I think one of the things that we were hoping that we could give parents and educators as they sort of walk away from this discussion is concrete examples around what they can do then. And the conversation was already going there, right? You were already talking about making sure it's documented in the IEP. But I would like to hear from each of our panelists if you had one or two key takeaways about what parents or educators can do, how they can engage in a sort of soundbite or a sentence or two, what would that be?
Make that connection and that relationship with your child's teacher.
Thank you, Candace. I can call in order if we want. Cheryl, I see you next, if you're ready to give
us. I'll go next. For me, we will not, the African American community or the communities of Black and Brown people are not going to see major change unless they organize and attack it from the top. Teachers don't have power to make policy changes. We need to address and attack the institutional racism that exists within education all the way and start having cultural competent requirements of curriculum and training for staff. We need oversight where actionable monitoring will happen to districts that are found to be disproportionately suspending, secluding and suspending our kids. We need political clout to tell the states that this is not okay. This has to stop. So I believe that we need parents to organize and to look for organizations like NAPSE, Alliance Against Restraints, COPA, and they are doing some public, we are all doing public work around these big issues. But I think we have to attack it at a higher level because it's not the teachers necessarily that have the ability to make some of the changes, the systemic changes that need to be made.
Thank you for that takeaway. Dr. Stewart, you're next on my little organization of blocks.
Just thank you guys for hosting this discussion. Hopefully it continues in the future. Again, this is my ministry. It's not my job. It's not my career. It's my ministry. I was that kid, and I see so many Black and Brown kids who are now in the system and not getting what they need. So thank you all. Thank you for the work that you do in your organization, and thanks for having me here.
Thank you. Celine, I see you next in my little blocks of folks there. What are your final words about what we can do, how we can engage?
I agree with Cheryl. It is about organizing. It's about agitating. It's about forcing people to have the conversation that we're having now as a country and call it out for what it is. And if people are uncomfortable, that's not on you. You know, parents have a voice at an IEP team table, and parents need to be empowered to ask for what they want. What their child needs. You're not being unreasonable. It's your kid. You do anything for your kid. So you're not being unreasonable. And, you know, I agree we need to continue to have these conversations. You know, I've known Cheryl a long time. We've been having these conversations for a real long time, as I know a lot of everybody else on this panel and those of you who are listening in. But, you know, now's the time to ask our schools, why do we have school resource officers? Why are we militarizing our schools and making them into little police states? Why is that? And it's time. I think it's past time. And pay attention to what happens in Congress. Pay attention to when people try to take away your civil rights. Because that's, you know, that march is on to take away our civil rights. And if it weren't for judges and lawyers continuing to fight to ensure that we still have rights as people who have children with disabilities, for people with disabilities, for people of color, you know, we got to keep fighting. We can't get tired. And, you know, the march is on to take away what we have fought really, really hard to accomplish. So be aware.
Thank you, Celine. Very important. Last but not least, Joy, any final words for us there about what we can do and how we can engage? Unmute yourself, Joy.
They just summed it all up. Like, I agree with everything, you know, like they said, just don't accept what you know is not right and fight for your child. And I appreciate you guys doing this. As somebody who has went through this, I kind of feel like Dr. Stewart, like this is not a choice for me. This is something that I have to do in order to fight for not just Black kids, but autistic Black kids. You know, and so I really appreciate, you know, there'd be a dialogue around this.
Thank you so much. I do want to thank each and every one of our panelists. I think that the discussion was super rich. And of course, we could go on about it for hours and keep sort of the discussion flowing. But sincerely want to thank each and every one of you for your comments, for your passion, and for the work that you do. And also all of the participants who were listening in. I know there are some comments in the chat. And I do want to just point out that you will receive an email with a link to the recording, as well as the contact information for our panelists if you wanted to follow up with them. And then at this point, I'm gonna kick it back over to Sue in case she has any final words, and we'll see about whether or not we can answer some of the questions in the chat for those of you who are still on. Sue.
Okay, well, I just wanted to thank our panelists so much for everything you've contributed tonight. It's been a wonderful discussion. And I, as Kim said, I will be sending out an email to everyone who registered tonight. It'll have a link to the recording that we've made, and it will also have some resources that our various panelists have put together that are, you know, about the issues that were discussed tonight. We actually, there was some confusion about the ending time. Some things, we said 8:30, sometimes we said 9. If the panelists can stay and if there are more questions that people have, we can keep going till 9 if there's a desire to do so. So maybe there are some questions from the chat or more things that if Kim, you wanted to ask anything further, or we can wrap it up.
I just want to give a shout out to my cousins and family that joined. Thank you guys for your support. I know that's a shameless plug, but I needed to acknowledge.
Okay, Cheryl, since you did it, I have to do it too, because I got a text message from my brother saying, you better say thank you for your family all over the country who are listening. So I am very, very appreciative of my family who joined us tonight for this discussion.
I did see.
Go ahead, Laura.
All right, I was just gonna say, someone did want to hear about Joy's experience heading back to Germany. Joy, I don't think you got to finish that story about that. So someone had mentioned that.
I was just saying, I know it can work because in Germany, my child is very, she's an adult. She's married now. Both her and her husband are both non-vocal. They're both autistic. They have 3 children, 2 of which are neurotypical. One is autistic, and they raise them by themselves. They not on any kind of disability, and they were able to get through. Well, you know, he's German, but she was able to get through the German public school system without being in special ed, number one. And number two, they never put hands on her. And she was considered aggressive, self-injurious, very behavioral, but they found other ways, like antecedent interventions, and never, that was not even an option. Like, it wasn't something that happened at all. And so I know that it can be done because I've seen it. And she became, you know, she works at the University of Heidelberg. She's successful. She's a researcher. But in America, she was considered lower functioning because of her behavioral issues. And they weren't seeing the whole child for who she really was because they can't separate the individual from the behaviors. But, you know, my experience in Germany was very different. They saw her as her, and her behaviors were just an aspect that they taught her how to use tools to get through. You know, they didn't see it as that's all she was and didn't destine her to, you know, to just not having a future because of them.
Thank you. I see a question in the chat for Cheryl. Cheryl, what was the name of that method using the mats? Is Cheryl still on?
Unmute myself. Sorry about that. Sometimes I started talking and forget. It's called Eucura. And someone posted the link for it. Guy Stevens, if you're still here, can you repost that link so people can check it out? It's done by Dr. Kim Sanders. It was an institution here in Virginia where they had a death. A student died because of during a prone restraint. And, oh, look, yes, he posted it. So you guys, you can post it and find out about that. And what they did, this Grafton, yeah, the school Grafton. So what they did, they came together and they actually, I mean, they were able to look at the death, take responsibility around that, but then use that experience to develop something that could save lives for children moving forward, because it takes away the need to control the child, to put hands on the child, and it allows the child to express whatever they need to express, whether it's sensory, not the ability to express what's going on, in a safe environment where the staff are protected, students protected, and the child can move on. In speaking with her, I know she saved millions of dollars just for claims to employment claims for staff getting injured. They don't get injured anymore. So it is a proven program. And I don't know, in our state, when we ask them to use it for our restraints and seclusion, school districts are saying things such as, well, we don't want to prescribe a specific method to any particular district to have to use. However, instead of looking at it from that money corporate perspective, we need to be looking at it through a human experience. And then Dr. Green, again, Guy, can you post his comfort versus control theories here? He does a lot of good work around kids that have the ability, the cognitive ability and the verbal skills to talk around and help them deal with the trauma that may be causing the escalation to occur. Is that helpful?
Yes, thank you, Cheryl.
You're welcome.
There's another question. This was from earlier on in our discussion around testing. So to clarify, what should teachers make sure to include in that conversation around opting in or out of state testing? How could they advise parents? That was sort of a question in the chat.
I tried to address it in the chat. You know, it is very state specific. School districts are required to report participation and achievement with state testing. And the federal guidance is that 95% of your students actually test. Each state determines what's classified as a subgroup. And typically students with disabilities is a subgroup in the school. So you typically want all students to test. And it ranges from state to state if students are required to pass a test or you just take it to take it kind of thing. So I didn't want to get state specific because, again, I am very, very new to the DMV. Again, if you ask me in Mississippi, I know exactly what needs to happen. You take the test to take it up to eighth grade, from third grade to eighth grade, and in high school, you pass a test to exit high school, so for a diploma. So I'm a little uncomfortable saying specifically here because it is state by state restricted or determined?
You know, the thing about the, and I agree with you, Dr. Stewart, absolutely. You know, I think that it's important for all kids to be counted, and that it is important to hold schools accountable for whether or not they're accessing a general curriculum and whether or not they'll be able to take a test, and in order to show what they know. That's the only way that we're going to hold schools accountable for teaching. And so that's separate. You know, the states made a decision to use the testing, what they call high stakes testing, in order to get a high school diploma. That's a state by state decision. That is not necessarily what the law required. That's a decision that the states made. You know, this testing, you know, goes all the way back to Clinton and before, the President Clinton administration. It's a long and varied history. So it's hard to opt out of it. It's hard to opt out of testing. Testing is how we make sure that our kids are getting what they need in school and holding schools accountable. But, you know, I understand that it is a parental decision, I think that it is a parental decision. You need to look at what your state requires.
Perfect. I know that Sue said that if folks had questions, they could start entering them into the chat. I don't see any. I don't know if Laura or Sue picked up on others that I may have missed.
I think we've got them all.
Okay, then I will if there's any, we have, you know, it's 8:51, but if there are any final thoughts or other things that have sort of sparked in your minds, our esteemed panelists, the floor is yours. If there was something that you wanted to get off your chest or wanted to stay but didn't have the chance to do that, now would be the time for that. And everyone's saying thank you in the chat. You're welcome. It was a great discussion. Yeah. Thank you.
I just want to thank you. And Kim, you did a wonderful job in moderating this. You got a lot of passionate people on here, and you were able to keep us online and on track. So I want to thank you for your great job. And I want to thank my fellow panelists. I think the insight that you all shared was even helpful for me. So I enjoyed doing this, and I look forward to more conversations like this.
Yes, thank you to X Minds for taking this on and inviting me. I appreciate it. It's a really important conversation.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Kim. You did a great job. And thank you so much to all of the panelists and all of the audience tonight. Thank you for joining us. Really was a great turnout, and I hope everyone got something out of it. I certainly did. All right, then. Thank you and good night.
Thank you all.